The Bookshelf Bookshop in Guelph, Ontario was established in 1973 by Barb and Doug Minette. In 1980, it became the Bookshelf Cafe, Canada's first bookstore cafe restaurant. Shortly thereafter, an ambitious plan to add a cinema and bar on what was then the roof of the bookstore cafe was conceived. During the implementation period of the plan, University of Guelph physics professor and longtime customer Jim Hunt trained a ragtag team of 10 cafe servers and booksellers in the art and science of 35mm projection. In 1988, the Bookshelf Cinema showed its first film. Over 20,000 shows and a million cinema goers later, the cinema continues to offer 14 to 15 shows a week with its fancy digital projection and great sound system. Shortly after establishing the cinema, Bookshelf.ca was launched, Canada's first full-time online bookstore sold to Indigo in the late 1990s. The Bookshelf team embarked on the Great Leap Sideways, expanding all aspects of the Emporium by rebuilding the building next door and adding a music venue, the E-Bar. Many great Canadian musical talents have graced the E-Bar stage. The bar serves up great craft beers and DJs and dancing every Saturday night. Over the years, the Bookshelf has operated a number of food and beverage operations, originally with its own staff and later in collaboration with others. In 2015, the Bookshelf welcomed Mijada, Let's Eat, as its restaurant collaborator. My conversation with Doug Minette starts with him in Europe with Barb, his future wife, the year prior to their setting up the shop.
But what we ended up finding is our packs just kept getting heavier and heavier and heavier, because we also developed this habit of going into bookshops in every town that we were passing through. And we ended up with a great library. But we also ended up with a profound appreciation and fondness for the towns that had the great bookstores. We didn't know it at the time when we were traveling, but in conversations when we got back that fall into Guelph again.
You were a student there, were you?
I was a student at University of Guelph, and Barbara was teaching. She had already graduated from university and had a teaching degree. And we would have these conversations at lunch, talking about, you know, how interesting and cool that was. Neither of us, having ever worked in retail before, much less the book industry, had no idea how we would even go about getting involved in the book industry. But we started to talk about it in the sense of, that would be an interesting thing to do. You know, instead of trying to herd grade 6 children and grade 7 children whose hormones are going insane, which is what Barbara was doing, and me thinking, well, what the heck am I going to do when I'm done taking all these math courses and philosophy courses and history courses, etc.? The idea started to coalesce around looking at starting a bookstore.
Because there wasn't one serving the community at that point, or what?
Well, we didn't think much of the ones that were there. There were actually 3 or 4. But in those days in Guelph, and I bet across Canada, a lot of the bookstores in small towns, there was a small book section which might be part of a paint and wallpaper store or a stationery store, but they really weren't focused on the books.
No, it's like, Mel Hertig's bookstore in Edmonton was, you know, one of the few dedicated bookstores between Vancouver and Toronto, right?
Correct. Basically, the number of smaller bookstores or even medium-sized ones, that was about to explode in the early to mid-70s.
What do you mean explode? What was about to explode?
Well, the number of people who I guess were like Barb and me, who thought that, hey, this might be a fun thing to do, and maybe a book section in a paint wallpaper store isn't really cutting it as a bookstore.
Okay. But can do better than that.
Indeed. But it was interesting because I decided that one of the ways I would go about finding out more about this was to start visiting publishers. So a friend of mine who had been in the bookselling business in Guelph, but who had left doing that to do something else, gave me some contact information. So I reached out to some publishers and drove into Toronto and met with a few of them.
Like who?
Well, one of them would have been Keith Topham, who was, I guess, a salesman working for William Collins, who was a distributor and publisher at the time in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting talking to Keith, because Keith basically told me that we were nuts and that Guelph had enough bookstores. And I think it's partly because Keith had been in the salesman side of the book industry since the 1930s.
So he was a traveler.
He was a traveler. He'd seen lots of stuff over the years. There were a number of them. Des Newell from U of T. He was a friend of Keith's. So all these guys had been around a long time. So I guess they had a notion of what would work and what a city or town would sustain.
Okay. So you set it up. You rented a place, I guess?
Yeah. Guelph, Ontario at that time had no shopping malls. Zero. A few strip malls, but very few of those. There was no such thing as a regional shopping center. And so, therefore, downtown Guelph was a very thriving place. Beautiful limestone buildings. It was actually an exquisite example of a mid-sized Ontario city. Therefore, trying to find a place to rent in that environment where people were doing well was difficult. So, you know, I learned about trying to get a place on the sunny side of the street versus the shady side of the street, and what was a good neighbor to have potentially as a bookstore. There were slim pickings, and we ended up picking a spot which we could rent, which was 1,000 square feet on a less than perfect location, but it was a start.
Okay. And so what'd you learn early on?
Well, because I was really scared to death about starting a business period, I didn't know that's what it was called at the time. And remember, calculators barely existed. They were mechanical calculators. I did a budget, which also had a timeline in it, which I learned later was called a cash flow. but I'd taken no business courses in my life. But anyway, I did a cash flow. And I was trying to figure out how we could stay alive. You know, what would be the point at which we would decide whether we were going to sink or continue swimming. Mm-hmm. And we decided that it was either we'd lose the 10,000 bucks, we had to buy inventory and some shelves and whatnot. So it was 10,000 bucks or 2 years, whichever
came
ran
first.
Out first.
Yeah. Okay. What'd you learn?
I learned that it was very complicated to try and buy books in Canada at the time. There were literally dozens of publishers. The books came from the United States sometimes, from the UK sometimes, from Canada sometimes. There was no universal way of finding out how to order books or even to find catalogs or get people to even be willing to sell to you. But I was lucky that early on in my research, I encountered a guy named John White who had opened up a bookshop 2 years prior to that in Oakville. And he explained the industry to me, the business cycle. When you sell most of the books, the fact that books are returnable, you know, a very unusual concept for most people in retail. But he explained to me what that cycle looked like. And it helped inform that cash flow that I had created to better understand what I would have to do in that first 12 months to even attempt to survive.
To what you have to do.
Yeah, what I had to do financially. What it didn't tell me how to do was to order books.
To choose the right books that would sell.
Absolutely. So the first thing we went to, of course, because we're all egocentric maniacs, is we went to our bookshelves. So we went to see the books that we'd been reading, and Barbara had been an English lit graduate. And we both read in all sorts of different areas. So we knew the publishers that we were going to need. We were going to need Penguin and Vintage and Bantam and Dell. And, you know, so all the paperbacks, because mainly we bought paperbacks.
And you figured that's what you would sell the most of?
Because we'd never bought hardcovers very much. I couldn't imagine people plunking down the money that would be required for a hardcover.
And you were young and it was a university town, is that it?
Yeah. I guess when we started, Barbara's 23 and I was 24.
So, okay. And there's a student population. Is that who you're trying to appeal to?
Yeah. I I thought we were going to be trying to appeal to people like us.
Okay.
And we had no idea what book customers would even look like. You know, we had a hunch it would be hopefully people like us would want to come into a store that we wanted to do, which was different than a paint and wallpaper store. Yeah, so that was the general thinking, but trying to figure out how to pick those books, because you're dealing with hundreds and thousands of choices you have to make.
Yeah.
With this limited budget.
And in fact, Canada was blessed with a gigantic choice, right? Because we had books coming from England and the States coming across the borders, right?
Absolutely. It was both a blessing and a curse because it was so complicated.
Yeah.
So it meant we had to open up accounts with many, many publishers to even get going.
Plus, I suppose you wanted to your clientele to buy Canadian. Was that a focus or not? It was to make money primarily, I guess.
Yeah, and actually to have cool books. You know, interest in selling Canadian books came later. That was a learned thing. And also, you know, I was an American-Canadian. I left the U.S.
Your parents were Canadian.
Right. Yeah. My parents were Canadian, but, you know, I grew up in the United States. So I was more agnostic about where my books came from.
Sure. Okay.
Anywhere as long as they're good was sort of my philosophy.
Sure.
So setting out to buy books was extremely difficult. And the woman I mentioned who had helped me provide contacts, she was willing to help go through what were called in those days checklists, to pick books out of those checklists that she thought we would need to start with.
What's a checklist?
It was for instance, for Penguin, it was probably about a 25-page little booklet, 8.5 by 11. And there'd be a line there, and there'd be a price, and there'd be a place to fill out a number, and that with your order quantity. So we would do that with the checklist for Bantam and Dell and AA. And
you just write to them and say, please send me your checklist?
Yeah. And it wasn't always easy to get them to respond because a lot of what were called mass market publishers, like Dell, AA, and Bantam in particular, at that time, they mainly thought their main part of the supply chain was rack jobbers. These are people who would put racks of paperback books in grocery stores, drug stores, wherever. But their focus was not bookstores. You know, it was that other part of the market.
Yeah.
That's what they thought the middle of everything was. So even to get some of those people to respond was challenging because some of those people who only wanted to deal with rack jobbers, the minimum order quantity was so large that they wouldn't ship to us.
So you went and got the books that you thought were the best books, that you loved the most, that you thought would sell. Then what happened?
I bought a cash register, probably not a necessary expense, but I would look at that cash register in those early days and see that we weren't selling much. We were selling little bits and pieces. And I remember the first day we saw what was a big, what was called trade title at the time was The Joy of Sex.
Mm-hmm. I read that as a teenager.
Of course. You gotta see how all this stuff works. I remember that sale because in those first few weeks of operation, which was the month of May, which is never a booming month in the world of bookselling anyway, it stuck in my mind, not just because of the title, but because of the fact that it was a trade book. It was something other than a small paperback that was being sold.
Hardcover.
Yeah, I think it was hardcover. Mm-hmm. And because that's how it came out originally. So it to me, I was shocked we could sell a hardcover. So we went through those lean early months. So we did gradually start to develop the inventory. It got better.
And I guess what you would do is listen to customers that came in and write down what they were looking for.
Exactly. So if somebody had read a particular title, you know, let's say one of the British authors that were popular at the time, you know, books like Chrome Yellow or even Huxley's books like Brave New World, these kinds of things.
And Chrome Yellow is Huxley.
Yeah. So, but we would start to expand the titles by that author, or we would find out that that kind of a customer also had a related interest in Robertson Davies or in Teaching Yourself So You Didn't Have to Wear Glasses. By doing eye exercises.
Yeah,
I can't think of the title of it.
Is it The Doors of... No, not The Doors of Perception. But but anyway, it's Huxley's.
Okay. So you would have these very weird interconnections that would lead us to seek out new titles, new authors, new publishers as we gradually expanded.
So you learned about your local demand.
Yeah. And who were these people? So originally, they were, as you said, you suggested when we were talking, university students or people who had just left university but were hanging around town working in bars, but they still were big readers. We only slowly started to discover people with more money that weren't university people, but who might be willing to plunk down money for a hardcover or a trade paperback, which would be more expensive than those little paperbacks. And those people originally, they didn't really support the paint and wallpaper stores much either. There was this snooty notion that they ordered all their books from Britnals in Toronto.
And just had them mailed to them.
Yeah.
So what they'd have to actually physically go down? Or the Britnals would mail out a catalog or what?
Or they'd phone them or send them a note and Britnals would send it to them. Because for many years, Britnals, you know, they were the grandparent of bookstores in this country. And it was a really good bookstore in lots of ways. And it used to rankle with us sometimes that they got preferred treatment by publishers.
They got better deals.
Well, not just better deals, but more rapid response. So if Britnals called a publisher to order a book for one of their customers, the book would show up the next day.
Oh, wow.
So Britnals was obviously the old-time favorite. Well, of course, there was Kohl's, the big Kohl's.
Yeah.
There was...
Edwards, is that one?
Edwards didn't come till later.
Okay.
But there was the bookseller. And the bookseller, their main location was on Yorkville. And they also had one on Yonge.
This is mid, early 70s?
Yeah. Okay. And I loved the bookseller because I was a big record collector when records were records. And they also had a great record collection. And I thought it was a great example of a modern bookstore with a great record selection as well.
So did you decide, okay, they're doing it, we'll do it?
Well, yes, it did happen, but that didn't happen until later. That happened in 1980, is when we ended up also selling records because I'd always wanted to do that as well. But in Guelph, the challenges in our early days was getting the books to our customers as quickly as we could because, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of titles available. And probably in our early days, we would have been lucky if we had 2,000 or 3,000 titles. So it meant that it was going to be difficult to satisfy people. So we were going to have to do special orders. So one of the things we did to try and increase the speed of delivery to customers and keep the cost down was to drive from Guelph to Toronto once a week and pick up books.
So you know that road pretty well.
Then. Oh, yeah. And I would actually visit 25 different distributors in Toronto in the course of a day and be back in Guelph by evening.
There were that many distributors?
Yeah.
Well, then what? Now, each publisher didn't have its own distribution center, did it? These were independent distributors?
Yes, and some of them were both publishers and distributors because at that time, I think a lot of publishers in Canada felt that the only way that they could survive was also being in the distribution business. So in other words, they would import a publisher's book from the UK or the US, and they would distributed here. So they would have a warehouse and take orders and ship it to the bookseller. So anyway, so yeah, the 25 was the usual number that I would visit once a week.
Wow. Wow. And so you pick all your books up and like what kind of savings did you get because of that?
Well, who knows? I think the main thing it was good from the perspective of customers. They saw that they had a responsive local bookseller who would get them the book quicker than Britnals would by mail.
So you know what? That's why Amazon's so damn successful today. So it's an important lesson.
Yep.
Get it to them quickly.
Yeah. And it was always a challenge, even with us doing that, because the fulfillment rate by those distributors was so pitiful. You know, it regularly was only about 30% to 50%. So in other words, order 10 books, you get between 3 and 5. So you'd be waiting for the rest of them for between 3 weeks and 8 weeks, if they ever came.
So in other words, you showing up on the doorstep improved that that percentage then?
Well, I'm not sure if it improved the percentage, but it improved the delivery time. Okay. Because if we had had to wait for them to ship them to us, it would have been a week or two later. And the other thing is the cost of shipping in Canada is quite expensive.
And even back then?
Even back then. It would have cost an additional 5 to 7%, and which is ruinous, you know, yeah. And later changed when most Canadian publishers, at least the larger ones, went to free shipping to booksellers.
When did that happen?
To tell you the truth, I can't remember. It was probably the late 70s, early 80s.
But again, you'd still have to rely on them to send it to you, which means
delays. And it means delays. And for years, the supply chain was really slow, you know.
So you, again, you circumnavigated that by driving right there and picking them up yourself.
Right. And I would say it wasn't until after 2000 that the real speed of publishers improved. And that's probably, you know, I hate to credit Amazon, but Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
They beat them into submission saying your turnaround times are awful.
Yep.
You have to improve that.
Okay. So then you started coming up with all sorts of ideas to what? Get people in your store?
Yeah, there was always that. So just quickly to digress, so that first year we discovered that there really were people who buy hardcover books. So when we went through that first Christmas, we were astounded. We were exhausted. All those trips to Toronto back and forth, selling lots of books. It was both exciting and exhausting. And we were such neophytes at the retail business, we didn't even stay home or stay open between Boxing Day and New Year's. We took the week off.
So all the returns is what just piled up waiting for you to get back in the store.
We didn't realize there was a huge business post-Christmas.
Because they've all got the money in their stockings or whatever.
Exactly. We had no idea. We were clueless. There was a learning curve, shall we say.
Yep.
So that first year and then the second year, it proved that we had something that could conceivably work. But we managed to move to a better location after those first 2 years. And the first 3 years, we continued to grow like gangbusters, you know, broadening the market, getting to know the community better, both, you know, students as well as the people who were, you know, were adults and had families, et cetera. So that continued to grow. And then the whole thing came to a grinding halt in about, what was that? 1978, when the first regional shopping mall opened in Guelph, complete with three of the chain stores, plenty of free parking.
Three of the chain stores, meaning what? Kohl's, Smith's?
And Kohl's, Smith Books, and Classics.
That must have been a big mall then.
Yes, it was a big mall.
Okay.
And it's still a big mall. And so that opened up, and basically the entire downtown Guelph was windowed out. The number of storefronts that were vacant was huge. Our sales plummeted by 30% in 1 year. So, you know, my partner and I, we were thinking, you know, I guess we could hunker down and have fewer titles and have fewer staff and limited hours. Or do we reinvent? And, you know, over the years, you know, I'm totally convinced that if you don't reinvent at least every 7 years, and that's probably too long a period, you will die. You know, it's impossible to survive. It's sad because one of the reasons that Barb and I originally decided to go into the book business was we thought it would be a nice, gentle person's life. We could order books, talk to customers, look at catalogs, discuss interesting things. You know, wouldn't that be
meet
fun?
Interesting people?
Right, exactly. Not have to worry about the bloody business. But alas, that's not true. So what we decided when we decided whether we would hunker down or try something else, we decided, well, let's look at what we might do. And that year, the few months following that huge collapse in sales, a friend of mine and I had started talking about doing a multifaceted business. And what we were in one of these large vacant spaces, you know, 15, 20,000 square feet on multiple floors. So we
you mean like a mall?
Except for it was one building. It was a big old beautiful limestone building in downtown Guelph. So we actually did a complete work of it. We did an architectural design for it, which we did on our own, and we business modeled it to what it would be, and the components of it was going to be the bookstore, a record store, a art gallery, a restaurant, and a bar, and they were all going to be in this building. And we got very close to doing it. We talked to a family member about potentially giving us the capital to launch this monster. But we had two young kids at the time. They were like
three. Too big a risk.
Yeah, 3 and 5. You know, we were busy with that. We just felt it was too much. But then our discussions continued, though, with each other, you know, with between Barb and me about what made sense. Because we did realize if we didn't do anything, the business was just going to slowly die. I found storefront was available that was smaller, but was big enough to try another concept that I had, which was to be a bookstore, restaurant, and cafe. So I worked up plans for that, did financial modeling for that, got a family member to pony up the capital for that.
That's nice.
And we ended up with a bookstore, record store, magazine, now selling magazines as well, and a restaurant cafe. And that we did that in 1980. And we were the first one in this country to do anything like that at all. Despite the fact that most of downtown Guelph was still in a serious depression, we took off like a rocket ship with that concept. We became an anchor draw from all over the region.
Did you get any help from the city?
No. Are you kidding? No,
the city, you're a tourism destination.
Exactly. But no, the city didn't help at all.
Okay.
But it was clear that the concept of bringing people together would make book sales jump. And the argument for bringing them together was different things you're selling them, books, records, mags, and people sitting around talking, much like we used to do at the till from the first day we were in that business. So that was our first experience of that. And that it was very exciting, but it was also difficult because we were learning a complete new business, mm-hmm. or a couple new businesses. We had to learn about, or three new businesses, the magazine business, which is horrible if you don't manage it properly, the record business, which had a horrible distribution system, way worse than the book industry. Even to get any of the record wholesalers to sell to you, very difficult. So we actually ended up using...
Why is that?
Because it was totally controlled by one company, Sam the Record Man. So this is an example where retail dominance can affect the wholesale level in any industry. And that's what happened.
In other words, they bought so much that the wholesaler gave them preferential treatment?
No, they really wouldn't even deal with smaller...
The wholesaler wouldn't because it's too much of a pain in the ass?
Right. You know, so basically everything was run from record through wholesaler to record retailer. They didn't want any hassles. They wanted it simple.
Yeah.
It's very similar to what happens right now in the movie business, where we basically have the studios, but access to those films is almost absolutely controlled by Cineplex Odeon in this country because they control 80% of the screens. So independent cinemas have no access or only limited access to those films because the big exhibitor in the case of films makes sure that they let the people who are actually producing the films, the production houses and distributors, they're saying, you give us these films first and as long as we want them. And imagine a similar thing in the book industry where somebody said, oh, I'm going to tie up all Atwood's titles. Only Amazon's going to have them because they cut the deal. Or only Indigo is going to have them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it creates havoc because everyone comes into your store demanding that book and you don't have it.
Exactly. But that's exactly what's going on in the film business right now.
Okay.
Which is fascinating. And yet it's a huge issue.
Okay. Getting, so bookstore.
Getting back to books. So anyway, so our you know, I said our sales were down 30% and they were barely up. So as soon as we opened the bookstore, cafe and record store, et cetera, our sales went up by 50% and they continued to grow. But again, after about 5-6 years, we saw those sales levels starting to level off again. And because we had originally considered the idea of doing a movie theater in that 1978 big idea, yeah, but which we hadn't actually executed, we figured, well, how about if we built another story on top of this building?
You didn't own the building, though. You just talked to your landlord?
Well, we had just recently bought the building.
Okay.
I did a theoretical design of what the building could look like with another floor that would hold a movie theater and a bar and an office and an expanded kitchen. So I did that design and then went to an engineer to find out if the existing footings and walls would support another story. and sure enough, they said yes.
Okay.
So I went, and so by this day, by the way, I wasn't using columnar paper anymore. I was using spreadsheets. And so I did a business model for this new model, which would include a movie theater.
Okay. So all this, for example, it's not the book business, but it helped your book business. Is that it? And was the book business at the core?
Yes.
Or it remained there, did it?
The book business has always been the core.
Okay.
Culturally, because of it, who it draws into the business. And it's fascinating to see the overlap between the book business and the movie business.
Every time an interesting movie, you run it, you've got all the associated books with it. Is that it or not?
That would be what the classic movie tie-in that they talk about. But it wasn't just that. It could even be something thematic, like, you know, Victorian England,
sure,
or fantastical whatever,
yeah,
that would trigger the interest in a group of books. Like what I was saying earlier about how we learn from our customers the linkages between different books, some which might be fiction, some which are nonfiction, you know, some which are historical, some which are modern authors writing, all that stuff.
But you want to run your movies for a relatively good period of, or a set of themed movies, so you can,
short
you
period,
don't have to change the books all the time.
Right, but we wanted to change the films a lot. We wanted to be running usually two different titles a day, alternating through a week. And a really big movie, one of the movies, it could stay there as long as 3 weeks if it was really cutting it.
Yeah.
But the other ones would be coming in. So we were trying to provide variation and different kinds of movies while only having one screen.
Right. But how did the book buying fit into that?
The busier the movie, the more books we sold.
But then you just kept reordering the stuff that's connected to that movie.
But it wasn't necessarily even related to that movie. It was just customers were brought in the store.
Right.
It's the theory,
yes,
of,
yes,
if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
If you build it and show it, they will buy.
So, even if it's unrelated to the movie.
Right. If you show them some golden nugget of fantastic stuff, the likelihood of people being interested in it and excited by it will have an enormous effect. It's why trying to sell books in a paint and wallpaper store is fundamentally different from selling them in a well-curated space where you don't have junk next to good books. You have good books next to good books.
Okay, so give me an example of what you did when you got a really good movie in. What did you do with the books? Is it just more foot traffic that it delivers for you? Or does it sell you more books related to those movies?
I would say it's mainly more foot traffic. There are exceptions to that, obviously. If you're, I'm trying to think of Ondaatje's book, English Patient, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
When that movie was showing, we obviously sold tons of English Patient.
Yeah.
Or Cider House Rules, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, when that book, when we were showing that film, mm-hmm, selling lots of that book and other books by him as well. So sometimes, yes, there was a connection. Otherwise, it was bums in seats, which means eyeballs on shelves.
You do anything else
Learn to become a projectionist.
You got to watch a whole bunch of movies too, right?
Yes, which was awesome. Yeah. And and also the first movie I ever showed, we showed Upside Down for a while.
Oh, good.
Because we spliced the movie together wrong. But you couldn't tell in that particular film for a while because it was a sex scene in The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Oh, yeah.
The Milan Kundera's great book.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious. So we were watching it. We go, it's right? Not quite right. So we had to have an unscheduled intermission where we got the sex right side up.
Okay, this sounds almost too good to be true. This did happen.
It did happen.
Okay.
It absolutely happened.
Okay, so anything else that you did that helped turn your stores and movie theater into a destination?
Yeah, we had dozens of events. And yes, we did book signings back in our original two stores before we had the restaurant. But as soon as we had the restaurant, we added live music in the restaurant. And we also had a university course that was in the restaurant. So we worked something with the University of Guelph. Various professors curated discussions with authors. So it wasn't you're just sit at a table and sign books. And they were often very interesting discussions that came out of it. Yeah. If you had the right guy. If it was a super academic who couldn't communicate, it didn't work very well. But if it was somebody who understood how to draw out the author and interest the audience, and sure draw on their expertise in their academic area, that was great. But it was mainly trying to pull the town and gown together in our venue. So we did that early on, and continued to expand that once we ended up with the movie theater, because we had more spaces to do it in. Sometimes with respect to films, sometimes with respect to books, sometimes with respect to things that the speaker was working on. But for us, again, it was always about that idea of ideas. The role of a bookstore as a curator and a place to facilitate the exchange of ideas, whether it was academic or through movies. And because we had filmmakers in as well, who would be doing lectures. I'll digress on that too. One of the things we did more recently with that is we had a secret cinema. And so basically we sold a series, which you had to pay for us upfront with a ticket price, 50% higher than our regular ticket prices. And we didn't tell them what the movie was going to be, but we were going to provide a movie that had not yet been released, and by a special arrangement with the distributor, and we would have a famous person come in and talk about the film or interview the filmmaker. So we've had anybody from CBC broadcasters come up there who were their film people. We've had people like Peter Mansbridge come in and interview filmmakers and talk about films. But that secret cinema thing sold out within a day usually. 250 people would buy that in a day.
So yeah, these are all different revenue streams too, of course.
Yep, but it's again, it's getting people in the building.
Mm-hmm.
This is all related to the book industry,
even
though it isn't necessarily the book industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, books are the only place where you can put complex ideas and have other people absorb them. Really?
I agree. And it's a very personal thing. It's you and your book lying in bed at night or sitting in a chair somewhere. It's you taking it in and filtering it your own way.
At your own speed and
your own time of day. You know, some people might say, well, if you're a CBC Radio 1 listener, you can maybe get some of that stuff through talk radio, like programs like Ideas or Quirks and Quarks or any of that stuff. It's true to an extent, but it's much more of a one-way communication.
Well, and it usually what happens is you listen to the hour and you say to yourself, if you're at all interested, I got to get myself that book.
Yeah, absolutely. Or guys like Terry O'Reilly talking, you know, in his marketing.
Advertising.
Yeah. And of course, he came, you know, to the bookshelf on a couple occasions, and is a great guy, great raconteur, and very.
It's a great show on CBC too. It really is. Yeah, it's eye opener.
Yeah, no, he's fantastic. We've had more people, all these writers from the New Yorker, and what you know, the number of people who have come through the bookshelf is huge.
That's great.
You know, and yeah. And you see, without a place like the bookshelf or in other cities where who do this kind of work, these things don't happen.
No, no. And the city still didn't do a damn thing for you.
No.
Okay, as if that's not enough. You opened up the hood and got into the back end of the computer by programming your own system. How'd that work?
Well, my father was early in the computer business in the United States where I grew up. You know, computers for him were like monkey wrenches or hammers. They're just tools. And in the late 70s, I started talking to him about potentially writing a system for me.
Why did you approach him? What was the problem?
Because... You know, at that time, we were probably up, we were north of 30,000 titles. And to try and keep those books on order and to be able to find them in the store.
Because this was all manual.
Everything was manual. When we started book selling, if a customer came in and said, I want to order this book, were the origins of the author, were they British, were they American, were they Canadian? That would determine whether you looked in Canadian books in print, which means American books in print, or British books in print. And then if you found it in two locations, you would have to do your best guess on where to get that, which publisher is the one who likely would be able to make that available for me.
In the quickest way possible.
Yeah, if at all. And so that was the mess at the time. So somebody wanting to order, do a complete Penguin order at that time, and even from Penguin, we probably stopped 2,000 titles. We'd take somebody 3 days wandering around the store, seeing how many we still had in stock, you know, if somebody had misshelved it, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing is if somebody phoned and said, oh, do you have this book? Well, some people have really good memories and would mostly remember if they'd unpacked it and put it on a shelf, but 30,000 titles is a lot to keep in your head. So anyway, that was that's the conundrum that one faces in the book industry. And so my dad said, oh, you know, I think I could write something. At the time, he was running University of Toronto's Library Automation Systems. He was head of that. And he just said, you know, I'll do it for you on the side. I'll build something for you. And so he started working on it. And we would have very long phone calls where we would discuss the logic of how the system should work in order for it to allow multiple users to access the data at the same time, which is an alien concept in computers at that time. Because in those days, if you had your IBM PC, it was a one-person system.
Plus you want to be able to update, obviously, the inventory, right?
Exactly. And you, if you had people receiving and selling and blah, you know, trying to do it with one machine, kind of an unrealistic notion if you were a busy store. So anyway, we managed to find an environment where we could have a design a multi-user system, it's called.
That was the innovation?
That was part of the innovation. So it was, I realized we weren't going to use MS-DOS to write this. So we were going to use a variation of an operating system called Unix, okay, which it was later known by the name of Xenix, which most people now know the Unix-like operating systems as Linux, mm-hmm. You know, which is the free version that Linus Torvalds, the Finn, did. But it's basically Unix, you know, underneath. That's what's going on. So anyway, my dad, he put 4 or 5 years of hard work, innovative work, in on the system, but it wasn't getting done. And so one very sad day, you know, I called my father and said, Dad, you know, this is really hard for me because you've done such fantastic work and put in so much time, you know, but this isn't going to work. I'm going to have to go out and buy something. You know, it's taking too long. So sadly, we stopped. And I went looking for about 6 months to see what other systems were out there. I didn't like any of them, especially because I'd put in the design time to realize how a system should ideally work. If you wanted it to be a very smart system. And so instead of you feeding the computer helped you. So, you know, having in mind the user interface, all the quick things you can do to make it smart. So anyway, I finally gave up looking. And rather foolishly, you know, my sister told me I was nuts. It was like trying to...
It's like your friends who tell you you're nuts right at the beginning, right?
Oh, exactly. And by the way, that same person who told me I was nuts in the beginning, he also told me it was nuts to do a bookstore cafe.
Okay. You know, yeah. What's he doing now anyway?
So my sister told me, Doug, that's like writing an opera, you know, when you haven't written a line of music in your life. But I decided I would at least give myself a little bit of time to do this. And my career in book selling, you know, as I've been saying, it's always books that have driven me. But I've always, because I'm distracted easily, you know, I've always done things off the side of my desk. You know, so whether it was being a director of the old Canadian Booksellers Association, or whether it was lobbying government, or, you know, serving on Canada Council committees or whatever, spending the time to see if I could teach myself to write something that would be industrial strength and good, I decided I'd give it a shot. And
you must have had some experience prior to that.
Zero.
Oh, jeez.
The first program I wrote added 2 + 2 and made it and printed it on the screen.
And made it
four.
So.
Yeah.
And made it 5.
No, exactly. That would be a Trumpian way of doing it. But
Orwellian.
Yes, exactly. I mean, so basically, I just taught myself, put the building blocks together, and then started stacking the building blocks up, and then assembling those stacked up blocks into systems. And after a couple of years, I had a system that I could think about loading and using.
That's pretty fulfilling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still had the day job. I still worked in the bookstore some of the time. I was the bookkeeper of the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And remember, I was the bookkeeper for a multi aspect business. And we kept separate books for all of them, so I had to do all that stuff. But Barb, you know, bless her. Like, I mean, she allowed me to keep working at this crazy project, and eventually we started using it about 1990. Up to that point, I'd also been a volunteer board member of what was then, it was the Canadian Telebook Agency, which was an organization founded by, I'm not sure really who founded it, but I guess it was jointly founded by the Canadian Publishers Council, at the time called the Canadian Book Publishers Council, and the ACP, and the Department of Canadian Heritage, because the Canadian distribution sector was very concerned about orders not going through the Canadian distribution system, but going directly to American wholesalers.
Okay. And you lost me.
Well, the notion was there was a Copyright Act in Canada which said that if you are reselling or buying books for resale, you have to be reselling the book that has legal copyright for this country.
Right.
So if Huxley's copyright was with Penguin, we would be selling the Penguin edition. It would be illegal for us to bring the same book from the United States and be selling it here.
Right, because they didn't have the rights here.
They didn't have the rights. And this was a thing that Americans found weird and bizarre, that we had that in this country.
Even though I think that ticked off, who did that tick off? Because booksellers were buying stuff out of the States and bringing them in and making money off them. And that ticked off the publishers who had the Canadian rights to whatever the same title was.
Correct. And remember I mentioned earlier that it was those Canadian publishers who were doing distribution as a side issue. They were the ones that were hurt by what they called at the time buying around. That's the phrase.
Yes.
Air quotes. Okay. And so the federal government wanted to assist in trying to keep the buying around from happening or discouraging its rise. And they felt that by putting together a teleordering system, as they called it, that would help speed the delivery of books. And the other thing that Canadian Telebook did was the publishers were supposed to provide their metadata, in other words, titles, authors, prices, who the distributor is, etc., to Canadian Telebook. And Canadian Telebook would publish it in a microfiche.
Which would then go out to all the booksellers.
Correct. So instead of having to use all those different books in print, we could use a microfiche, which would know everything. So in that era, you started to see the emergence of microfiche readers in bookstores across the land.
Yeah. How long did that last for?
It's hard to remember, but I would say a good 10 years with that.
Mm-hmm.
So Canadian Telebook was providing that. They also, it was interesting because this was an important precursor to what happened later in terms of book industry organizations, is that they also thought that it was their responsibility to try and share technology with publishers, mainly publishers, to try and get people to use an arcane thing called EDI, which is basically the ability for computers to talk to computers directly without humans in between. So in other words, this computer...
But
it didn't necessarily need the internet. So Canadian Telebook used a messaging system that Bell had. This was pre-internet that they were using this thing. So basically, you dial up with your computer to this Bell thing, upload this file, which was your order, and it would deliver it to the mailbox of a publisher. The publisher would dial in at some other time, pick up the order, download it, and put it into their system somehow.
And then eventually ship it to you.
Right. So it was an attempt to try and improve the broken telephone problem of the distribution channel.
Okay. Who spearheaded that again?
That was Canadian Telebook did that.
Why did they do that?
Well, because it was trying to protect the Canadian distribution system, which was a major factor in propping up Canadian independent publishing. So that's the reason for Canadian Telebook, to try and discourage buying around.
The publishers lobbied the government, and the government put up some money to help improve this distribution system for Canadian publishers.
Yeah. So these were the early steps. Because remember, the government was already funding Canadian indie publishers, but they realized there were other problems with this. Being satisfied.
Okay.
So that was Canadian Telebook. And at that time, because I was sort of a geeky guy and had started getting into programming, I started attending some of these geeky EDI committee meetings with, you know, some people from the three chains. It was basically the three chains and me and a few publishers would go to these meetings. And the executive director of Canadian Telebook asked me to start going to New York with her to attend tech meetings, you know, on metadata for books and on EDI.
Telebook, was it a government agency?
It was an NGO, but it was funded by the government. I don't know if there was any publisher money in that or not. I think it was 100% government funded.
Okay.
Anyway, so I started going to those meetings, and I met a bunch of people from around the world who would attend these things. I found these meetings quite bizarre because they would talk about standards for EDI. And the problem with a standard is there's a million ways you can implement a standard. And there were so many ways that nobody really knew what anybody meant.
You mean the standards for the metadata to be communicated?
Yes.
Okay.
So there was a standard which said, you can do this, this, or this, or you can do that, or you can send this piece of...
Useless standard.
Yeah, exactly. You might as well just send somebody a text message. You know, it was that useful. But I would sit there, and I met a couple of really smart guys who eventually, you know, drinking after these meetings, I'd say, this is...
That's
really,
where all the work gets done.
Yeah, this is really dumb. This is going nowhere. So I started proposing at meetings that instead we have a working group. We weren't going to just discuss standards. We were going to discuss how to implement the standards.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the lead in that, whether it was in book metadata for the books and print type stuff, or whether it was the subject codes that were used in metadata for books, or the EDI. So I was involved in all those areas of trying to make it sensible instead of people just blathering on.
Well, plus you were living it every day in the bookstore, so.
Yeah, so I really felt it, you know, if the subject codes were ill thought out. Really.
Why didn't you just use the Dewey system?
Well, there was Dewey and there was Library of Congress. Except for bookstores, they're called BISAC codes that the book industry generally uses in North America. But they are even kind of useless because you ultimately have to decide where you're going to shelve the books. And if there are 100 subdivisions in literature, you're going to decide how you're going to shelve that stuff. But you aren't going to do it 100 different ways, because nobody will ever find the book.
Well, plus each store has its own unique way of shelving stuff.
Right.
As well it should be.
And that's why you map these things. So very early on, I realized that you had to learn how to map things like subjects to shelf locations. Or
so what does that mean, map?
Map. It just means all these subject locations are going here. In other words, so if there are 100 of them in literature and I decided I only wanted one literature section, that's where they're going to go, all of them. But on the other hand, I might say, well, this group, because one of the notions that one of my early friends in the business talked about is he thought that what he called literature and translation should not be shelved with other fiction. I guess it's a bit of a Tony thing to do, but I always liked it. And the reason I liked it is because it meant that if you were interested in French literature or Russian literature or Eastern European literature, you're much more likely to trip on something that's going to turn you on than if Tolstoy is next to somebody else that is not Russian. You know, so to me, shelving books is a very important way of leading people into the next mm-hmm. book they might read.
You want to try and put yourself in the customer's head when they go in the store and say, where am I going to find this?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it's about.
Right.
So the way you shelve books, whether it's on the internet, in web stores, or whether it's physically in a store, is really important to what's called the discovery process.
Yeah.
You know, and so to me, those techie meetings that I was attending in New York, in my brain, they translated into how will this affect bookstores when we finally get these bloody systems working the way they should be working.
Right.
And Bizac subject codes were originally very, very U.S.-centric. And I started getting them involved in making them far more, not just Canadian, but international. Come on, guys. The U.S. isn't the only place in the world. Mm. And where possible, I would introduce and get acceptance for Canadian-only subject codes. That, to me, was an important role for Canadians to have at the table in New York, because most of the books that sell in Canada are published in the United States. In terms of subject codes, it was to North Americanize it. So if a publisher said, this book is fiction, general fiction, it's also Canadian, it's also literary fiction, they could put all those in.
In there, yeah.
And remember, when I was first involved with that, the internet wasn't there, so people weren't using these Bizac subject codes. But you see, you needed a lingua franca.
Yeah.
You needed a language that the publishers, the people in editorial, the people in sales at the publishing houses understood why these things mattered, because that's how they ended up being cataloged. The people at the far end of the supply chain for this data, they wanted to see how other people were.
Well, that's how they're thinking, right? That you want they, and it's the same sort of thing. You want these publishers basically to put themselves in the brain of the bookseller,
yeah,
so that the bookseller could find what they want easily,
and the public can. So, in other words, what are the real subject areas for this title that we've just published?
Mm-hmm.
And so it forces them to go beyond just thinking of, oh, this goes in that section of the catalog. These are what this book is about. They can be 5 or 10 subjects in some cases.
Right.
You know, is this book a YA book by a Canadian author? Is it a YA book for kids 9 to 10?
Okay.
Is it a book, you know? So in other words, all these different ways of slicing and dicing.
But apparently this isn't available now.
Well,
this isn't. No, it is. Well, this is what this More Canada report says. You can't find Canadian books.
That isn't the subject area thing. So what that has to do with is book industry metadata. And the subject code thing is only one part of that.
Okay.
Think of it as a subcategory of that. The More Canada report was talking about the lack of ability to capture the nationality, not just who had the publishing rights, but the nationality of the author and how you define that. Am I an American or am I a Canadian?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so either definition issues. And then you have to figure out.
And that's not available now?
It's becoming available. And because the metadata standard called Onyx has continually grown to
Isn't
be able
to... Isn't that Schwartz's company name? It's just a coincidence.
No, he is O-N-E-X, and Onyx is O-N-I-X.
Okay.
And so I don't think Jerry's very interested in this. But
well, yeah, we've got to be careful here, too, for our audience, because this is getting pretty granular.
Oh, exactly. So just anyway, so basically, yes, due to the expansion of this Onyx standard, publishers now have the opportunity to say, this guy is from not only from Canada, but Robert Munch is from Canada, but he lives in Guelph.
That's perfect. So it's this possible. It's just a question of making sure that the publishers fill in all the stuff.
Correct. So this is where the geeky tech stuff meets the kind of requirements that are raised in the More Canada report, for instance. And that all came out of Canada's participation in the evolution of Onyx. It was originally the Brits were the ones who started it and oversee it. But the Americans and Canadians are all right in there with them in developing the sophistication of the metadata, which allows publishers to convey information that is useful. So it would mean that, you know, if somebody is buying a book that, oh, that guy actually lives just down the road from me, you know, I'll be able to have a get together with them.
Yeah.
So those things definitely matter.
But they're available now. It's just a question of convincing the publishers to do the extra work. Is that it?
Yes. The ability to convey them is available now. The willingness of publishers to invest the time, that's their problem.
I see. But if they want to sell the books, that's obvious. It's obvious they should do it.
It gives them a hook. I totally agree.
So there isn't a problem here other than motivating the publishers to do the obvious, which is provide information that will help sell their books.
Right. And BookNet Canada, who is the successor organization to Canadian Telebook, they actually have somebody whose job is to educate publishers about using these newer versions of Onyx to make sure that localization and nationality information ends up in the data record so we all can make use of it. Again, we have this lingua franca, but we have to use the vocabulary that's available.
Okay, so you took care of succession. Your kids are running the show now, right?
That's right.
You're not retired because you're now the acting executive director of the Canadian Independent Booksellers Association.
That's correct. I have a hard time retiring. I guess I never will.
Okay, so what's the biggest challenge right now for you?
As an executive director?
Yeah.
When you're starting an organization up like this with potentially hundreds of members in different categories.
Yeah, potentially how many?
Okay, I would say booksellers in this country, we could have 200 members who are booksellers.
That's it.
That's probably it.
That's tiny.
Yeah, Canada's not a big country.
It's a big country, but it's not a big country.
Correct. Another challenge when you look at that is of those 200 booksellers, the sizes of the booksellers and therefore their needs, some they share, some are quite common. Things like some of this tech stuff we've been talking about, because everybody benefits from that. But some of them are very different. The larger store have more staff.
Do you want chains in there as well or not?
No, we don't want chains.
Because there's only one big chain.
Correct. Well, there's some smaller chains, but we decided to have an arbitrary limit of up to 10 stores. So one store to 10 stores.
Pure Voice.
Yes. Pure Voice reaching out to publishers, writers, and the government.
Okay. So what the most important thing you want to accomplish?
We want it so Canadian booksellers can sell more books, improve the quality of their offering to their customers. We want them to be able to improve their performance in the Canadian supply chain, therefore for Canadian publishers and Canadian authors. We see us at the confluence of the creators, the publishers, and the public. That is our unique role, and no other NGO in the book industry in Canada fills that role.
I don't understand. What's wrong right now and what needs to be fixed and who should do what?
Okay. there's a complicated answer to that, because if you asked the 200 booksellers, you get probably 200 different answers. Ask the maybe 50 publishers, 50 to 100 publishers.
Here's, for example, it seems to me that government should cut the taxes for bookstores. Like maybe it's municipal governments, so you should work with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, and you should get the damn cities to stop taxing bookstores so much.
That is something that I think is in the More Canada report as well. The other thing is, up until the GST was introduced by the Conservatives, there was no sales tax on books in Canada. They were tax-free.
Right.
So that is something that would have been available to the federal government. We lobbied at the time, and we were unsuccessful. In Ontario, there is no Ontario component to it, but there's still the federal component to it.
Okay.
So the feds get their 5%, but the province foregoes their 8%. But that is an example of lobbying. So if I were to say, what are we really wanting to do? We want to lobby all the ministries and government that touch bookselling. An example would be, I did a survey in May of booksellers from across the country. I got almost 100 responses within a week and asking people what
They're not short on opinion, are they, the bookselling community?
Well, I was happy to see that.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I forced them to be quite specific in what they wanted.
Okay. And what'd they say?
Well, I would say the thing that ranked highest, because it's something that they have to deal with all the time, is shipping. So there are a number of aspects of shipping. You know, I talked earlier in this conversation about me picking up books in Toronto because it was the quickest way and the cheapest way for me to get them there. That remains as a big issue. So if you're in Ontario and you're a bookstore, shipping is both fast and relatively cheap. Okay, we'll talk about inbound shipping first. So inbound shipping, because of close proximity to the major distributors, or they're close or in proximity to the distributors who ship for free. So, for instance, the large companies like Simon & Schuster and Penguin Random and
the foreign-owned ones,
they ship for free. But even though they ship for free to all parts of Canada, if you're an Atlantic bookseller in PEI or a BC bookseller on Vancouver Island, the length of time it takes to get books is dramatically higher.
So it's the same old story, basically, that you had right from the very beginning.
Yeah, the huge Central Canada advantage. So one of the things that clearly we are going to try and work with publishers, because we can't do this by ourselves.
No.
But we can do it by trying to help to grease the wheels of the supply chain by working with them. Let's say there was consolidation among the not big guy, the guys not big enough to run a truck right across the country every day to keep everybody happy.
Yeah, the Canadian-owned ones.
Exactly. So is there room to help facilitate collaboration on that kind of stuff?
Right. In other words, everyone hires one truck.
A consolidator.
Yeah.
And so you negotiate, you get a good rate on a truck. And they know it's going to go this way.
Every day.
Or maybe what you discover is there isn't a full load and therefore that's too expensive. Oh, but you could fill a truck. If everybody tried to get their orders in by such and such a day, then you're going to get the stuff way quicker.
And it's evening the playing field with the foreign-owned companies in Canada.
Correct. So that's the inbound freight issues, inbound from the publishers to the bookstore. And so booksellers in Western Canada or Eastern Canada, they talk to me about it quite a bit. Okay. And I say, I get it. Maybe there's some creative ideas that we can get working here to improve things. Who knows? Maybe we could actually share a truck with Penguin Random if you're a Canadian-owned indie. You know, maybe we can get them to be, you know, play nice.
Outside the box.
Exactly. So in terms of online shipping, everybody in the industry that's pivoted to online sales, and most of the indie booksellers in the country, or many of them, have done an excellent job of going online to sell books to try and keep their stores from, you know, tanking completely. So if you do local delivery, you can find a way of doing it.
Yeah.
You get in your car, drive around.
That's the question about the distributor, right? Like, is there an Ingram's in Canada?
No.
Maybe they should set up a shop.
I think the numbers wouldn't work. Ingram has warehouses strategically located based on their sales. Having worked with those guys as a consultant over the years, I know their systems and I know their top people, and they make smart decisions.
Yes, they gotta make money.
Yeah, and they're they've had to adjust as the world has changed. You know, years ago when I knew their senior people, Amazon didn't exist. In fact, they were doing a lot of the shipping for Amazon at one point. So obviously that isn't the case anymore.
They're competing with Amazon.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
That's one of their pivots.
The whole idea of bookshop.org is that the wholesaler does the shipping. The bookstore doesn't get involved. They just get paid.
Correct.
But you're saying this because of the fact that we have a decentralized distribution system in Canada that doesn't lend itself to that? Is that it?
Okay. The U.S. has a hybrid. Ingram was strategically located, very rapid shipping. They're an excellent company. They know how to do that. But the discount you get if you're a bookseller is crappier than if you buy directly from Penguin Random or from Hachette. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you give up margin to get speed. And American booksellers therefore operate very differently in their stores. So in other words, they will decide how much speed matters more or margin. So because people like Penguin Random have really improved the quality of their shipping, more and more booksellers are using Ingram less because they make more money and they get the books almost as quickly
directly
from the publisher instead of buying from Ingram.
Okay.
So that's why the American system is a hybrid and it's constantly in a state of flux because of these changing dynamics. Whereas Canada, there's no such thing as a central wholesaler. There's a couple smaller regional wholesalers. There's North 49 in Toronto, but they only stock 3,000 titles, you know, or so. And there's Book Express, which is a division of Raincoast in BC.
Yeah.
But it only stocks a small number of titles too. But they attempt to fill that space on a select few titles.
Nationally.
Right. But it's tough, you know, and they charge for shipping.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, you are 5 to 7 points behind with a poor discount from a wholesaler than you would get from the publisher if you go that route. But it you use it as to try and keep your shelves full of something that's flying off the shelf.
We've established your bona fides. You're a good person to be the head of this association. That's for sure. So have you said everything you want to say to the book trade, let's say?
I think the opportunities in the next year and a half, even during COVID times, to do things that would normally have done in the olden days at a bookseller's convention in Toronto, where everybody would get together and drink, you know, and talk.
Can't drink over Zoom. Well, you can drink on your own over Zoom, but...
And I do.
But it doesn't quite cut it, does it?
So my founding board of directors for the booksellers group, the Canadian Independent Booksellers Association, CIBA, we have been having often weekly meetings and we drink and we discuss what's next. And to me, it's remarkable what you can do, even though it's great to be in person with people.
Yeah.
CIBA is going to rely on the Zoom.
For the foreseeable future.
Yes, it's going to be you doing it for professional development. We're going to be working with publishers to allow them to reach out to the booksellers who join us. We're going to be using it for booksellers to reach out to publishers for the same reason.
Yeah. Okay.
And in the case of authors want to speak to the group. Guess what? We're going to allow you to schedule so we are going to be doing things. Things which we couldn't have done in the 1970s or 80s or 90s or aughts with the old Canadian Booksellers Association, we are going to be able to do with CIBA.
Okay, so what's the website?
CIBABooks.ca. And that's spelled C-I-B-A books, plural, .ca.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with me in person. It doesn't get better than in person, but sounds to me like you're really going to be doing something amazing with technology too.
Well, thank you. Canada is a leader in that, and we're going to take advantage of that leadership and push it out the door this way too.
Thanks again.
Okay, cheers. Thank you.
I'll be speaking with Doug Minette, who is the acting executive director of the Canadian Independent Booksellers Association.